Welcome to Around and About Chattanooga. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller. Today is Monday, April 11th. And first thing on the show today, I'm really excited about the guest that I have. I'm speaking with an astronaut from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Dr. Ray Seddon was actually one of the first female astronauts at NASA, and we're going to talk about what that experience was like. She's written a book about it. It's called Go for Orbit, One of America's First Women Astronauts Finds Her Space. So she's joining us to talk about her historic career. Dr. Ray Seddon, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure to be here with you, Mike.
So you're a medical doctor, a physician specifically, and when you were a resident in Memphis, an offhand comment you made actually led you to becoming an astronaut. Tell me about that time in your life where you were a resident in Memphis. It sounds like it was a pretty interesting hospital, a pretty interesting thing to be doing.
Well, it certainly was. You know, I had grown up in the space age knew a lot about space just from the early flights and Sputnik and everything, and sort of had in the back of my mind maybe I could be an astronaut on a doctor on a space station someday, but it was totally unrealistic. So I went to medical school. UT back then didn't take very many women. There were 6 women in my class of 100 when I came in 1970, but had a very good career there. I felt well accepted by both the professors and my fellow medical students. And yes, I had decided when I was there that I wanted to become a surgeon. Now that was really crazy back then. They had not taken women into the surgery residency before, but they took a chance on me. And I happened to be working with a plastic surgeon, Dr. Robert Reeder, in Memphis, and we were fixing a nice lady's face up for her. And he said he had to fly his family to Florida for vacation after we finished the case. And I asked if he had an airplane. And he said he did. And I said, oh, gosh, you know, I've always wanted to take flying lessons. And he said, well, I happen to own a flying school out at the airport. Come on out sometime. And happened to just get a private pilot's license. I asked for flying lessons, the ground school, and a few hours of flying from my father for graduation from medical school. And so I became more familiar with the flying world. And then, of course, when I had the opportunity to apply to NASA, we applied in 1977 for the first group of astronauts that was going to include women and minorities. And it was really important that I had a pilot's license. And I think that was one of the things that made me a little different from perhaps all the other thousands of people that were applying. I had the background, the technical degree, in surgery, had done some emergency medicine on the weekends, done some research in nutrition on surgery patients, and had that private pilot's license. So it was an opportunity I was glad that I took him up on.
How did you actually become a candidate? What was the application process like?
Well, I found out rather serendipitously that they were going to take applications. A fellow resident had done some research with NASA before he entered his residency. And we were sitting in the doctor's lounge in the middle of the night one evening, babysitting patients in the ICU. And he said, what would you be doing if you weren't here? Well, of course, this was kind of a low spot in the residency. It was just working terribly hard. And I said, oh, I'd go be an astronaut. Well, he had done that research with NASA. And a couple of weeks later, he said, well, NASA's taking applications for the space shuttle program. And I said, well, how do you apply? And he said, I have no idea. And so I just addressed a letter to NASA Houston, Texas, and requested an application, and the letter somehow got to the right people. They sent me all kinds of forms. Non-military astronauts came into the program as civil servants. So I applied, filled out a whole stack of forms about, you know, what my background was, what I'd been doing, what my interests were, other credentials that I had, and sent that in and was invited to come down for an interview.
How big of a deal was it for women to be possibly accepted into the program back then? How groundbreaking was that?
Well, it was rather unusual. And, you know, before that, you had to be a man, and you had to be a pilot. You had to be a test pilot. They did let some scientists come in, I guess in the 60s, because they were looking at going to the moon. They had a physician and a geologist and some engineers. So they did let some men in, but there were no minorities and there were no women. And I'd heard that after I came in that there was some controversy about that. A lot of the men felt like they shouldn't admit women, that they couldn't do the job. But NASA, when they accepted us, I think those of us who came through the selection process were surprised that they took six women in our class of 35. We thought they would try it out on one or two women and make sure it was going to be okay. But there were six of us, so we formed a nice little support group and helped each other. And but there were never any real problems. Maybe whatever concerns the men had, they didn't express them, and they gave us a fair chance. And once they found out that we were serious about what we were doing, that we were willing to do the work that was involved, I think we were very well accepted.
And so you grew up at the time of, you know, the moon landing and the early space missions. Not that astronauts aren't celebrities today, but back then, I mean, they were huge celebrities because everybody watched basically the same TV channels. So that was, astronauts were somebody you really looked up to at the time.
Right. And I think all of us knew their names and all about their lives. There were Life magazine articles about them, and the men drove fast cars and had beautiful women hanging around. But we also heard about all of the wonderful things that our nation could be proud of that we were doing in space. But I think once we got to the shuttle era, it wasn't quite as much hoopla about it. And the fact that there were 27 astronauts in the program when our class came in, and then our class had 35. And I think much to the dismay of some of the men in the office, there was a lot of attention about the women. So, our classmates, the men in our class would say, there's the six women and then 29 other people.
Because, I mean, you started getting national attention as soon as you were accepted into just the early stages of possibly being an astronaut.
Absolutely. And I think we had to learn as we went along, you know, how to appear before the press and, how to answer questions that could be taken the wrong way. And there was a lot of scrutiny of us. But and I think that at first the press didn't know how to portray women in very serious jobs. I can remember doing interviews with some very good reporters that we talked a lot about the benefits of space, and then to have the article written about what kind of makeup I had on. And it was disconcerting. And so we had to learn to speak well, what things we wanted to appear in the press about the shuttle program.
Yes.
Maybe a little bit about us, but to stress the fact that we were serious scientists.
And I think even today, it's still very important for an astronaut to have good PR skills, because that seems like that's a crucial part of your job, is just plain PR.
Exactly. And that was actually part of our training when we came in. Unfortunately, not very early on, but after a few months, we did have some training in how to speak in front of the public, how to phrase what you want to say, to have facts on the tip of your tongue, and how to direct the conversation to something serious when it tends to be moving in the direction that you would prefer, you know, where do you buy your clothes and
yeah,
things like that. That wasn't really what the astronaut program was about, or the space program. So we learned. Some of us learned by making foolish mistakes and having it on the television or in an article. But we learned that among all the other things that we learned to do.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Dr. Rae Seddon, an astronaut from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Her book is Go for Orbit, One of America's First Women Astronauts Finds Her Space. Me, when I grew up, it was the shuttle. It was very much the era of Challenger, for example. And I think one of my earliest memories of, you know, really being aware of the space program is when the tragic accident with the Challenger happened. You know, I would have been in middle school at the time. We were watching it on TV. Of course, we didn't know what was going on. And so it was huge news coverage for days. For you, though, I mean, I can't even imagine what it was like for you, because those people, those astronauts were your friends, your colleagues, people you knew very well.
Absolutely. It was kind of reality setting in for those of us who didn't have a military background. You know, I married a fellow astronaut who was a Navy fighter pilot and had been in Vietnam and had lost friends and sort of understood how all that would work and what you did afterwards and learned how to deal with it. But I think those of us who hadn't been in that world had an unrealistic, I guess it was lack of concern, because we had never lost anybody in space before. People had perished in the Apollo 1 fire, but that was on the pad. And I think even though we understood that there were many parts on the shuttle that could fail, we didn't really think that that would happen. And I think not only were we naive, but NASA was too. They didn't really have a plan for what would we do if. And so it was a learning experience. It was a very sad time for us, though. Several of the people on Challenger were classmates of mine, and we knew their families. Our children went to preschool together. It was just tragic. It was hard for me. I had never lost a close friend or a whole group of good friends all at once. And we had to learn how that would come about. And I think it made us more realistic about what might happen to us on our next flights. And we had to decide whether or not we were going to stay with NASA and face that risk, or whether it was time to move on to something else.
How much of that was a thought for you, that maybe after seeing that you should stop doing the astronaut program?
I don't think I really thought about leaving. I had been working and training on a flight that actually should have gone at about the same time as Challenger, so it was kind of close for me. And I was married to a husband who loved his job. He had landed 10 days before the Challenger happened. And I think we both felt like that we were willing to take that risk. We were very invested in that. I think it helped that we both had flights that we felt very strongly about. And that's why we decided to stay. I think we supported each other in that decision. I think there were astronauts who might have stayed, but their wives were just terrifically frightened because they saw what happened to the people that the Challenger astronauts left behind. It was very difficult for those families. But we decided to stay, as did many others.
Speaking with Dr. Ray Seddon, her book is Gopher Orbit, one of America's first women astronauts finds her space. And in the memoir, one of the really interesting things I think you say is that during training, the problem wasn't that you were a woman. The problem was that you were small. What was that problem?
You know, I tell people that a lot because they think, well, probably being female was somehow was more difficult for us. I think that the larger women didn't have necessarily as much trouble, but there were large pieces of equipment that we had to deal with. After Challenger, we had to wear big pressure suits that were very heavy on their own, but then you put the helmet and the boots and the parachute pack on the back, and it weighed upwards of 80 pounds. And that's not too bad for, you know, a 200-pound guy to lug around. For a 120-pound woman, it was difficult. There were other things in our training. We had to do scuba training because people trained for spacewalks in a big water tank. And if your suit flooded, you had to learn to take a scuba regulator from a safety diver and not panic, because they couldn't get you out of the water very quickly. And that was hard for me. I wasn't a swimmer. And so I was afraid that's how I was going to wash out. And this was perhaps less than a year after we had come in, but I thought, this is, you know, this is one I can't do. And then I realized that it was as much mental as it was physical, and that there was a way that I could figure out how to do what I had to do. And I did. I just practiced on my own and just tried really hard, and I guess gained enough confidence that I could pass that test.
You were talking about your husband being an astronaut. Hoot Gibson is his name.
Yes.
And you met him through the astronaut program, and you were later dubbed the mother of the world's first astro-tot.
True.
What was that?
It was very interesting. When my husband and I married, about 3 years after we came into NASA, we were the first couple that married each other in the astronaut program, so that was kind of a big deal. And I had to decide at the time, I was 34, and I had to decide whether or not I wanted to have children right away, thinking that I might be in line to be the first woman assigned to flight. And I decided that it was more important for me to have children than to get early flights. And so we decided to try. And sure enough, about 14 months after we married, Paul was born. He had a little problem with his breathing at birth. He had to go to the newborn intensive care unit in Houston. So there was a write-up about him in the newspapers. And there was a nice little blurb in the Time magazine Milestones column. It's usually about people dying, but occasionally there's someone that's born that makes it into that. And they talked about his birth, and they dubbed him the world's first astro-tots. Now, that may have come from somewhere else, but that's the first time that we saw it. And an astro-tot is a child born to two astronauts. So it's a pretty exclusive club.
And there's some really cute pictures in your book of you and your husband and your child all in matching spacesuits.
Exactly. The kids all, as they were growing up, had little blue suits that they could wear for launches and things like that. As long as we could persuade them to wear those later on, it became polo shirts with crew patches on them. But, you know, at first, they liked having their little spacesuits, too.
How many children do you have? I believe Hoot had some children from a previous marriage as well.
Right. When I married Hoot, I inherited Julie, who is just one of my favorite people. And then I birthed three astro-tots after that, so there are four of them all together.
What was it like for them having two astronaut parents? I mean, that's something most people in the world will never know, having two astronaut parents.
I think for the younger three, it was just part of life, because we all lived in a community south of Houston where everybody's family was part of the space program, and their friends had astronaut parents, and you know, other people went down for launches like they did, and it was just part of life for them. I think kids are kind of amazing and just taking it for granted that this is what life is like. And I think the first time that my older son realized that things were a little bit different was when his, I guess it was about his fifth grade class, got to talk to me in space during one of my missions on the ham radio. And I think the newspaper came out and interviewed him and some of his classmates and teachers about what was going to go on. And I think he finally realized that his was a rather unusual life. And, you know, but it took a while. And, you know, that's why I wrote the book. My children lived through that. But it just sort of went by them. It was just part of growing up. And didn't think that they understood what really was going on in the background and how difficult it was to have a family, a job, kids, and a big career. But we managed it. So I wanted them to have some appreciation of what was going on at the time. And they've all read the book and learned a great deal from it.
That's Dr. Rae Seddon. We're talking about her book, Go for Orbit, One of America's First Women Astronauts Finds Her Space. It's really interesting because I didn't realize this until I read your book. Being an astronaut, you're usually not up in space. That's really a very small part of the career. Besides training, which is obviously one thing you're doing, what do you do as an astronaut when you're on Earth?
Well, you know, I like to tell people I spent 19 years with NASA and spent 30 days in space. So, yes, there's a lot of time. A fair amount of that time is training for a flight. The big science flights took perhaps 2 years or more to train for, in which time you learn all of the equipment, you learn what's going to be on the flight, you learn how to operate everything, you learn how things can go wrong and how you can fix it. And then working with mission control and the simulators, you simulate those flights. And so that takes a lot of time, but it's very interesting. And you really get involved with the people that are going to be on their flight and their families and the people that are working with you. You get really close to them. And then you fly and you debrief and then you move on to something else. But there are many other jobs supporting other astronauts. You can be an astronaut in mission control. You can be an astronaut who's working on a particular system that's coming down the road. You can work on being a support crew for a crew, helping them get ready for their flight. Many different things. I happen to work on a number of medical issues with my background as a physician. How do you make sure that the experiments that are to be done on the crew members are safe and that they understand when they sign up for those experiments, what the risks are? What do we carry in the medical kit in space? And how do we train non-physicians to be the crew medical officers? Because not all flights had a physician on board. So how do you teach a fighter pilot to be a doctor? My husband always liked to volunteer for that position on his 5 flights. And he was full of questions about things. Why do they do that way? Why do they do that way? And, I hope I don't ever have to do that to somebody. So there were a number of things that, you did because of your background and your specialty.
And it's interesting because when you were up there in space, it's not like today where you can have, where everyone in the world can have a live feed of what's going on up there. It sounds like communication was fairly limited with what was happening back on the ground.
Absolutely. On my first flight, the way we communicated, we had voice communication with mission control. We could downlink some pictures of us doing activities, but they had to send all the real information up to us on a teleprinter, which was just a machine that could generate, typed messages. And the only way we could communicate with our families was to send text messages down, and they could send text messages up, but all those messages were read by the people in mission control. So it wasn't really very private or satisfactory. You didn't really say too much. And then as time went on, we developed better ways to do that, because being in touch with your family was so important. By the time my husband made his last flight in 1995, he could set up a camera that would downlink pictures of him, and we talked via ham radio. There's a little man in Australia that helped us, as we were passing over that part of the world. He would switch back to who's speaking, who's not.
Oh, wow.
He got to hear all those conversations, but it was wonderful that somebody in the outback in Australia was helping us communicate with our families. So it really did change. I'll have to tell you something. One of the people that I flew with on my third flight stayed with the astronaut program after I left. And I was delighted to see that he was going to fly to the space station once it got up and running. And I was in my kitchen one day, and the phone rang. I picked it up, and he said, "Hey, Ray, it's Bill MacArthur." And I said, "I thought you were going to be on station." And he said, "I am on station. We can make cell phone calls now." So it was just incredible the way that the technology developed. And, now it's a little bit easier to talk to the folks at home and others.
One of the really interesting things you say that I've never heard before is that sometimes food tastes different in space. Why is that? What food tastes different?
I think they've tried to figure that one out because we had the opportunity to choose our menus. There's some pretty good food that we could fly on the shuttle. Took some fresh foods, apples and oranges and bananas for early in the flight, some dehydrated foods, casseroles and things like that, chicken and rice, peanut butter. Everybody wanted to take dehydrated coffee, which, the coffee crystals don't quite taste like the real thing, but it's not too bad. But when they got up there, they suddenly found out that things tasted different. At first, they thought it was the water because they put a little iodine in the water to keep the bacteria from growing. And then they found out that really wasn't it when they decreased the iodine in the water. And they think it's because a lot of our taste is actually smell. We smell the foods. And when you go into space, the fluid in your body redistributes. You get a little bit of a stuffy nose. But I don't think they completely understand. They found on the early missions that everybody was putting hot sauce on everything, or lots of salt, or lots of pepper. And your first flight, you have to sort of try everything out and figure out, well, this tastes good, or that's too bland, so that you can figure your diet on your later flights a little bit better.
And while you were up there, one of your experiments that you were doing was on that very subject, fluid redistributing the body. What were you trying to figure out?
Well, we knew in weightlessness that instead of some fluids being more down towards your feet because of gravity, suddenly it redistributes and equalizes. And so when you first look in the mirror when you get to space, you look terrible because your face is all puffy. You look like you have a bad hangover. And they talk about the bird legs of space. Your legs get skinny. That was interesting. It didn't seem to be causing any problem. But then people began to think, well, what does the heart do? What does the kidneys do in this situation? And when does it equilibrate? And how does it equilibrate? And, how long before, you don't have a headache anymore? And so we did some studies about that, found some kind of interesting things. The heart, because it doesn't have to pump against gravity, at first, because of the fluid redistribution, it swells up because it's got more fluid
around
it.
Which sounds like it could be dangerous.
Yeah. And then the kidneys help you to lose all that water, and then the heart shrinks back down. But the heart muscle doesn't have to pump as hard because it's not pumping against gravity, and there's some decrease in the heart muscle. And we haven't found any problems with that. It's just interesting to know that that is what's going on. And, of course, when you come back from space, you can get lightheaded because your heart, again, isn't quite used to pumping that. Your blood pressure receptors are out of shape. They've forgotten how to regulate your blood pressure. And you're basically dehydrated because you've lost all that fluid. So we had to learn that you had to take additional fluid before you came in for a landing to help you not feel faint when you stood up when you got on the ground.
How long did it take you to acclimate back to being on Earth?
Well, my longest flight was 2 weeks, and I could actually tell the difference between a 14-day mission and the previous mission, which had been 9 days. I didn't feel a whole lot of difference coming back from the 9-day, but after 14 days, I got a little woozy when I stood up. But it would take 2 or 3 days to begin to feel normal. The scientists who were doing studies on us were picking up changes like in our balance and our mobility after a week, 10 days. So you can feel quite well, or at least you could after shuttle flights, in 2 or 3 days. At first, your balance was off and you tended to stagger around. You had to be careful going upstairs because you had forgotten how it felt to lift your foot high enough to go up the step. Again, some people felt a little faint when they stood up suddenly. So there were a number of different things. We know that people who stay in space longer have other problems, and they do a rehabilitation program.
That's Dr. Ray Seddon. Her book is Gopher Orbit, One of America's First Women Astronauts Finds Her Space. What is your website where people can get the book?
Oh, thanks for asking, Mike. It's just astronautrayseddon.com. If they just Google my name, they'll be able to figure that out. The book is only available through the website right now, but we've had a lot of interest in it. People have enjoyed the book and told their friends, and I'm always delighted when I see that people are ordering the book. I've been surprised that people from all over the world are ordering the book, so I'm glad that people are enjoying it. That's why I put it out there. I wanted to tell a rather unique story.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure, Mike. Thanks for the good questions.
That was Dr. Ray Seddon, R-H-E-A, S-E-D-D-O-N, Rae Seddon. And by the way, her memoir just won gold in the autobiography and memoir category at the Independent Book Publishers Association's Publishing Awards ceremony, so congratulations on that. You're listening to Around and About. I'm Michael Edward Miller.
Around and About Chattanooga is a production of WUTC with contributions by the staff and volunteers of WUTC. Find us online at wutc.org.